Welcome to FinTech's DEI Discussions podcast series. This is the Humans of FinTech chapter, and we are here today to celebrate the wins, raise awareness of the challenges, and walk the talk for change across the entire financial technology industry. Today, we are joined by Mary Williams, CTO at Plio. They are here today to share how they walk the talk for inclusion in our sector, and more importantly, what more they want done. Mary, welcome. It is great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. It's really good to be here.
Tell us a bit about Plio.
So Plio is a fintech based out of Denmark, and we basically do spend management solutions. And what that means is we give companies and employees cards to spend on. And then rather than having to keep track of all your receipts and keep a folder and make sure that you've got everything to do your expenses at the end of the month, basically, as soon as you spend on your Plio card, you just take a photo of the receipt and that's your expenses done. It tends to take expenses from something that everybody hates to something that they're like, oh, this is quite enjoyable. It's not anywhere near as annoying as usual. And so that's what Plio does. We're now expanding into all sorts of other areas of payments and spend management, as I said, and helping companies to actually optimize their spending. As you can imagine, of course, with the current environment, it's getting more and more pressing to save as much money as possible. And so we're helping with smarter solutions to manage your money as well.
Absolutely. And I can imagine a lot of people are in now that you said that. Yeah, you hooked me on the expenses made easy. I'm here to listen and learn for sure. As CTO, I'm very excited to hear more of your story and to share that with the audience. Please tell us more.
Yeah, so I'm from what's a fairly typical background. So I did a computer science degree at the Uni of Bath. I am from South Africa originally, and I was a bit of a hardware hacker growing up. So I built part of South Africa's first satellite as a teenager, which my advice to parents is therefore don't let your kids do anything cool when they're young. I soldered something that went into space when I was 16. It's all been downhill since then. but yeah, it was a pretty good start, and then moved more into the software side whilst I was at uni. I then did my first 10 years of my career at Procter & Gamble, huge consumer goods giant, I was still quite technical, so I did lots of architecture and coding, but then moved into product and project and program management. And then towards the end of my term, they ran all of North European operations, so everything for UK, Ireland, Nordics and Benelux. And so had quite a diverse range of responsibilities, everything from like infrastructure to telephony to actually the facilities as well. P&G has a unit within it called Global Business Services, which is basically a $1 billion company within an $80 billion company. So I was part of that. I then realized I wanted to be a bit closer to the tech than I was able to be at P&G, and left. And I was going to go to Google or to Amazon. And then a guy called Tom Loosemore rang me up and said, hey, we're going to fix the government. Come help us do that instead. And so I scaled up the team that built gov.uk. As part of the government digital service. And then since then did a couple of smaller things, and then ended up as CTO for MarksandSpencer.com, then moved to Moo. I was then at Monzo, which was my first real fintech role, for a couple of years, then Helix, which was AI-driven drug discovery. So again, a very different world, and now back in the fintech world at Plio since last year. I also do some other stuff on the side. I'm an advisor to a VC. I sit on Flagstone's board, which is a savings platform. So if you want smart ways to save money and to spread your money across banks so you get the maximum protection from FSCS, they're really good. And then I chair a conference called Lead Dev, which is a technology leadership conference. So I have ADHD, and it shows a little bit in my career is how I tend to talk about that.
It's so exciting, right? Like, even as you're talking about it, it's almost like gaining momentum. Like, I feel if I was listening to music, it would be speeding up and the tempo would be going. Like, I absolutely just loved hearing that. It's super inspiring. And one of my favorite bits is that you weren't always in fintech, and you've got such an insight into different industries, gives you a super powerful insight into fintech. So tell us a little bit about this industry from someone who's worked outside the space.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think it's so ripe for disruption. There's so much, I think, because of the regulatory aspects and there's almost too much of an acceptance that things have to be done a certain way because of that regulatory aspect, where actually I think something that Monzo did particularly well and Plio is also doing really well is finding that way to be brilliant for customers and to be in line with the regulatory needs. But sometimes that's forging a new path, finding a new way to meet those needs rather than doing it the way that it's always been done. And I think we've seen, I've seen certainly at both companies, moving from changes being made on a quarterly, monthly basis is what people expect maybe in the banking and traditional finance world, to deploying hundreds of times a day being absolutely normal. And it was a little bit like going back into that government digital service type world for me, where it was like, okay, this is a very traditional industry with a very, in many ways, old-fashioned way of doing things that then needs to figure out how to take advantage of all of the new developments we've got in software engineering and in technology, without losing that compliance with the regulatory side of things. And so I think that combo of other regulated areas that I had some exposure to was really helpful when I came into fintech. And also having just had some exposure to really good consumer experiences, right? Because I think, again, the consumerization of IT means that people are now expecting things to be as good as their iPhone is or as good as the apps that they use every day are. And so if you've got then financial services that don't work as well, it doesn't go over great, right? And so I think that marriage of regulatory and statutory requirements with high expectations that people have now of the apps and products that they use is a really interesting space to be in.
Yeah, isn't it just? And I really like that. I really like that the demand is high, that it's expected that this should work and work really well and be accessible, and people should be included, and it should work for people in different locations with different experiences and meet their requests and what they need from particular products. And I really like how that all connects to really the topics that I'm super passionate about, inclusion. And in our previous conversations, you said to me, intersectionality is super important. And I'd love you to explain it to us from your perspective.
Yeah, so I tend to joke about this a little bit. I say I'm the one the Daily Mail warns you about. So I'm an immigrant with a job, which I think is worse than living off the state, but I've got to check the headlines regularly to be sure. I'm a woman working in tech, which is a bit unusual. I'm actually non-binary, so that makes me even more of an outlier. I'm disabled and neurodiverse. I've got a physical disability as well as being autistic and ADHD. I'm queer. My wife is British. I'm over here stealing your women and your jobs. And then I also have the reality, though, of I grew up white in South Africa during apartheid. And so I had this immense privilege that was completely unearned, right? I didn't do anything right to be born this particular shade of pale, but I had access to educational opportunities and work opportunities and all sorts of things that I wouldn't have had if I'd been a different color. And I think that's made me both, I'm very intersectional myself. I'm diverse in a number of different ways from a number of different angles or vectors. But then in this one particular way, I'm hugely privileged and very aware of it. And I think that's been a really interesting lens for me personally to have, is that I'm in the minority in all of these different ways. But then in one really important way, I'm in the majority. I'm in the privileged group that got so much special treatment, particularly in South Africa during apartheid, that it's given me that dual vision of being both given huge advantage, but also being very disadvantaged in other ways. And that's been a really interesting thing to experience. I think it makes me more empathetic to people who are unaware of their privilege. There's the saying that, or a quote, I forget who it's from, that if you're accustomed to privilege, then equality can feel like oppression, because it feels like something's being taken away from you. And it might be, but it's because you had far more than you ever should have had. You've been given more than everybody else. And now making it equal means something goes away, but it doesn't have to be a negative, right? A level playing field is what we should all want for ourselves, but for everybody else. I don't think it's not a real win if you started the race 100 meters in front of everybody else. And I think that realization is quite uncomfortable for many of us. But if we're really honest with ourselves, we want to win because we've got great performance and we've done really well, not because somebody let us start the race 100 meters in front.
Really powerful words, and I think that hits hard. Who wants to win the race when they've started 100 meters ahead. And what you've said around dual vision, really powerful, because actually that in itself is something that's so unique, and you're really using that for good. And imagine if all of us use our privileges or our unique positions for good, what impact that could make. And I know that some of the good that you're doing is actually the work around fully representative conferences. And I wanted you to share some of that with us. Tell us what that means and show how you do it.
Yeah, one of the things we cared about from really early on, not just myself, but Ruth Yarnett, who's the CEO of Lead Dev, was to make sure that as a tech conference, we were fully representative of the countries we were running in. And so what does that mean? That means that we look, when we run it in London, we look at the demographics of the UK. When we run it in Berlin, we look at the demographics there. Same for when we run it in New York or in San Francisco. And we try to make sure that the people on stage are representative of the world. And so in the US, for instance, that means 40% people of color and then 20% Hispanic. In the UK, it means at least 15% people of color. It means as many women and non-binary folks on stage as there are men on stage. And there's a real pattern in tech conferences that there's the token woman. There's an all-white, all-male lineup. And then somebody goes, oh, that looks a bit off. We'll just change one of them. We'll just have one person who's a bit different. And that's just not good enough. We need to have as many women on stage, and they need to be given as much airtime as the men are. One of the things that I found fascinating as we look at the call for proposals, the proposals for talks people send in, women are much more likely to say, oh, I could do this as either a 30-minute talk or a 10-minute talk. Men are often only putting in 30-minute talks. And so we found that we had to be careful not just to make sure that there were equal representation in the speakers, but in the airtime as well. But we don't just do that. We do a lot of outreach to different groups in technology, women in tech, people of color in tech, LGBT in tech, etc., disabled groups. And we try to go to those communities and very actively say, we want your voices, we want your experience, we want to hear from you. Because the default assumption is not that you're welcome if you're in any of those groups. The default assumption is that you're not welcome. You're not part of the people who are viewed as authoritative and worth learning from. And so we do a lot of outreach. We do some just basic logistical stuff, like we will pay for the travel up front, pay for the hotel up front. We don't have speakers go into debt in order to speak, which is actually a really common thing with conferences, that they expect you to take on a lot of the costs yourself and then wait a few months to be reimbursed by the conference. We make sure that if people feel uncomfortable walking at night or something like that, we'll provide taxis. And it's all just some of these things are quite small and they feel a little bit trivial perhaps, but they're really important to make people feel safe and welcome. And I think if you set the bar at, we want to have full representation. And in order to have that, we need to make everybody feel like they can be themselves, be successful, and feel safe and welcome. That's a very different bar than a lot of places set. And it's really paid off for us. We're at the point now that the top of the funnel is representative. We're not cherry picking to find those women or those people of color or those LGBT folks. They are represented at the top of the funnel, and that then translates into them being picked at the end of the day as well, just because we've done all the early work to make sure that those folks know that they're welcome and that we want their perspective and their point of view. And a lot of tech is lacking that perspective and that point of view. And so it's been hugely successful for us to bring those new voices into the room.
And thank you for sharing all of that, because I genuinely believe that people listening to this will sit there and say, I haven't thought about that. Especially on the taxi thing, going home late at night. Now that's, considering that, would actually hold somebody back from taking up an opportunity or having to fork up the money up front knowing they're not going to see it for 3 months. That makes someone's decision, I can't take up this opportunity. And what's really struck me is twice this week so far, I've been given the option of a 10-minute talk, a 30-minute or a fireside, and in both I've gone, completely up to you, whatever works for your schedule. So I'm really glad you shared that.
And it's not a bad thing to be flexible, right? But I think on the conference organizer side, you've got to notice that flexibility and go, ooh, we've got to just make sure we're not giving too much airtime to the people who are being inflexible. Because you don't want to select for inflexibility. It's never something you'd put on your list of things that you want, right? But realizing that certain demographics are more likely to be accommodating to shape themselves into the shape that you need because they're used to having to change themselves. We're so used to having to mask or code switch different words depending on which community you're from, but we're so used to having to shape ourselves into an acceptable shape. And there are some demographics that just don't do that. They just turn up as themselves every day and everybody accepts it and is used to it. And it's sometimes a little revolutionary to turn up as yourself if you're different enough from the people who are traditionally in particular roles or industries.
So interesting. And I'm really loving how you're bringing this all to the fore for people to understand and see it. And often it'll be seeing it for the first time now that you've highlighted it. And so much of this podcast so far has been about inclusion, including everybody. And I'm a big believer that the more people we can have to champion inclusion, the more change that we'll have. So from your perspective, how far have we actually come as an industry?
I think we've made some progress. When I was a student, which is a couple of decades ago now, I'm getting on, I very seldom saw women or people of colour in leadership roles at the companies that were coming to speak to us at university or where I interviewed. I could count on one hand the number of folks who were not a straight white dude that I had met during interview processes for internships, for instance. And I think that's changed. I think you see a lot more representation, and that now we're at leadership positions as well, where we weren't always. It's not where I'd like it to be. Even my most inclusive, best organizations that I think I've had have been 30-40% women and non-binary. They've not been 50-50. But even when you've got a team that's 30-40%, people are like, wow, look at how representative this is. Look how inclusive this is. Look how diverse this team is. And I'm like, yeah, but it's still not good enough. And so I think we've come quite some way. And I think the other thing that's changed is if you think about inclusion as, or diversity, inclusion, equity as a sort of scale, I think we've moved away from the really blatant sexism that, and homophobia and racism that it used to be perfectly acceptable to go, you can't put that her on that project. She's a woman. Of course she wouldn't understand it well enough. And that was very blatant and easier to combat in some ways because it was so blatant. And so if that's the one end of the scale, and like true inclusion where everybody can be themselves and be successful is the other end of the scale, I think we're more in the middle. We're in the kind of microaggressions, which is telling a young boy that they're very clever, where you tell a young woman that they're very pretty, and those kind of small things, asking people, but where are you really from? Which is always interesting. My favorite is when people realize I'm foreign, they go, oh, your English is very good. And I'm like, it's my mother tongue. I've been speaking it since I was born. Not since I was actually born. I'm not some sort of prodigy, but I've always spoken English. So it's not, my English isn't particularly good for a foreigner. It's my mother tongue as well. But I don't experience anything like the level that other immigrants do because I've adopted my wife's very middle-class English accent at this point. But I think all of those, there's this microaggressions and apathy or just saying it shouldn't matter or it doesn't matter. And sometimes that's harder to fight against than the really blatant stuff. Trevor Noah has famously said that the big difference he sees between racism in the US and in South Africa is it was so blatant in South Africa, nobody could deny it was happening. Whereas in the US, you have to be the detective to prove that it's happening to you before you're allowed to then try and address it. And I think the UK is a bit like that as well. I think we don't talk about these things openly or realistically enough some of the time. And it can then make people feel a bit gaslit. They're experiencing something, but they've got to convince people that their experience is valid before they can then try to combat it. That's really tough.
Really tough. And the emotional baggage that goes with that is huge, and the knock-on effects of that. And I'm so pleased that you brought this up because we see this a lot in recruitment. I remember 2004, 2005, sitting with hiring managers, talking through, this is where we were then, like VB6 developers. And if ever I had a female CV, it would either be discounted immediately and I'd be berated for not knowing her football team, or all the questions would just be at a completely different standard and she's not going to get through, and I don't blame her for not wanting to. Whereas now there's many instances where I'm working with companies who are saying out there on their websites, we want to change, we want to do this. But when it comes to the people who are hiring, I have to go back to them and say, do you realise you've seen 32 Java CVs of individuals who identify as female and you've only accepted one of them as a placement. And by the way, your average CV to placement ratio of men is 4 or 5 to 1. Do you realize the behaviors? And that's it, isn't it? It's here's the data. Let me show you're behaving badly. Yeah, very interesting point. And it takes me to my final question, which I always ask everybody, because I introduce these podcasts saying we're here today to walk the talk. And that's because I love to drive action and to drive change. And I think a lot of what we've discussed today is there's a desire, but there's also a need for action. And so to anyone listening to this podcast right now who's inspired and feels empowered to go and do something, what would you like to see more of them to shift and change and drive inclusion in their workplace?
So I think when somebody's choosing whether to join, whether to stay, whether to say yes to a promotion, whether to say, I'm off, I'm going to my next thing, they're asking themselves three questions, consciously or subconsciously. They're asking, am I expected here? Is someone like me even expected to be in this team? And for instance, as somebody with a physical disability, I've never interviewed anywhere where ahead of time I knew whether I'd be able to get to the interview room if I was on crutches that day. In all of my 20 plus years of working and job hunting, that's never been something that I've known without having to actively ask and therefore come clean that I've got this disability right at the beginning of the process. Similarly, I get people in tech companies in London going like, we don't understand why we don't have anybody over 25 applying. And I'm like, your benefits page literally just lists foosball and beer Wednesdays. Are you sure that's what everybody over 25 is caring about? That kind of thing. So am I expected here is the first question. Am I respected here? Are my differences seen as a feature or as a bug is the second question. And then the last one's the most important, which is, can I be myself and be successful? And so what I'd encourage everybody to do is to really think about your team, your organization, your company. Could enough people from a wide enough range of backgrounds say yes to those three questions, that they are expected, respected, and that they can be themselves and be successful? And I think that's what really matters, because we talk a lot about diversity, which is having those differences. But what really matters, is, as you say, is inclusion. It's being able to actually be yourself in the day to day and to bring that difference that you've got to bear, to go, I've got a different perspective on this because of my background, because of my experiences, because of the life that I've led. I'm going to add more to this team by having that different perspective, but only if you allow it to shine through. And so if you will take people who are different, but then you expect them to act and be exactly like everybody else who's already in your team, then you're not getting any of the benefit of that difference. You're not getting the true value of diversity. You're just getting the very surface layer. And that's not where the value lies. And we've seen this in the research, that actual inclusion is what drives the business value and the improvement and the innovation and the results for the teams and for the businesses. It's whether people feel like they can be themselves and be successful.
And what a wonderful way to draw this podcast to a close. Mary, thank you for joining us on FinTech's DEI Discussions. Let's listen, let's learn, let's walk the talk.
Thanks for having me.